Good morning. It's now my privilege to represent Nai Say Lee. And I want to talk about two issues here. There were three raised in the brief, and with respect to the challenge made to the use of the third-degree assault conviction, I would like to simply submit that argument on the briefs and discuss basically the use of the second-degree sexual assault conviction as a predicate conviction for the career offender sentence enhancement. And I would also like to talk about the four-level bump, which was noted in the pre-sentence report and would be relevant if this court finds that the second-degree sexual assault conviction does not qualify as a categorical crime of violence. In this case, I don't know if the court has any questions, but in this case, my argument was, as briefed here, was that the looking at the Alaska statute that sanctions sexual penetration of an incapacitated person, that was the offense of which Mr. Say Lee was convicted, and the specific statutory section that we look at has language in the statute which allows for a broader definition of potentially allows for a broader definition of incapacitated, such that this would not qualify as a forcible sex offense. And I hang my hat, as it were, upon the language in the Alaska statute, which says unless the context requires otherwise and gives a definition of incapacitated, that essentially says that incapacitated is a person who's temporarily incapable of understanding that she was engaged in sexual penetration with the defendant. That's essentially how that's been, that's essentially how you read it, or but physically unable to express fluently.
But doesn't the case law say that is typically inebriation, drug stupor, mental defect, or I suppose a person could be just flat out unconscious. What other situations could that phrase refer to that is any different from the Louisiana statute that we interpreted in Riley?
Well, because we're supposed to give meaning to every section of every piece of statutory language, and because I couldn't find any case specifically referencing the unless the context requires otherwise in Alaska case law, what I did find was, in fact, a second definition of incapacitated person in the Alaska statutes that arguably could be utilized in this context.
Well, can you? I mean, I've given you the four categories that I can think of. This is a fairly common rape statute in most states that if the victim is for some reason unable to give consent, that it constitutes rape. What other category could there be besides the four that I just gave?
I would like to respond to that question, but also reserve whether or not this is a typical statute of this type.
Okay.
There's a question of legal incapacity. There's in the Alaska statutes under the guardianship statutes, there's a definition of what constitutes an incapacitated person for the purposes of that statute that basically describes a situation in which a person who requires assistance in dealing with their daily needs is assigned by the court a guardian. And that is actually a designation of a person as an incapacitated person. I think.
But isn't that the same situation with a person who's mentally incapacitated, retarded, for example?
No, there are lots of people with developmental disabilities, schizophrenia, what have you, who aren't necessarily mentally unaware or
But in Riley, it doesn't specifically account for that situation, both in the statute but also in the opinion, where he says, Riley attempts to characterize this crime as nonviolent because the victim may initially consent to the sexual encounter but lack the legal capacity to do so. That's what I understand you to be saying.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that with respect to looking at this Alaska statute, that because
that leaves open that possibility.
Beg your pardon?
That leaves open that possibility.
It
that
leaves open
may consent but lack of capacity to do so.
Well, no, I'm saying somebody who's designated as an incapacitated person under the Alaska statutes may still have the legal capacity to engage in sexual penetration or something sexual.
Well, it may have physical capacity. It may appear to consent, but...
No, they may actually be... I mean, there's nothing in the Alaska statutes that says that a person who's incapacitated for the purpose, say, of, for the purpose of the guardianship statutes is prevented from legally exercising their consent to sexual intercourse. Because guardianship, of course, can be imposed for a variety of different needs and problems, but it doesn't necessarily take away that individual's capacity to consent to sexual intercourse. So I guess my argument is that not only do we have this wiggly language, unless the context requires otherwise, but we actually have an alternative definition in the Alaska statutes of an incapacitated person that doesn't necessarily meet, you know, any parallel in Riley, because you could have a person who is, quote, incapacitated, but nevertheless has the legal capacity.
But we don't have any Alaska case law that interprets the unless the context otherwise requires language.
We don't have any Alaska case law that defines that.
And how does the language help you anyway?
How does the language what?
Help you anyway.
Well, it helps me in this regard, that we're looking at a statute to see whether or not the scope of conduct could exceed that of a categorical forcible sexual offense. My argument is that its expansive language suggests that this could encompass.
But that language just allows for the possibility of a situation where the language could be expanded. If you can't come up with a single example that fits within that, it's just a theoretical possibility. I don't know what... In of itself, I don't see how good it does it.
Well, I think...
It just allows for the possibility there might be a context, maybe not one that exists now, maybe the one that's created by future statutes or by future changes in the law or something. So I don't think that introductory phrase helps you.
Well, I think what it suggests, though, is that sex with an incapacitated person may encompass a scenario that is broader than a categorical forcible sex offense.
This would be somebody that's incapacitated from
has that legal characterization from a court appointment, perhaps for being an incapacitated person.
Well, that may go to the consent issue, but how do you deal with our language in Riley that talks about, as an element of whether this is a crime of violence, that there is, and I'm quoting from page, 1159 of 183F3rd, that it also subjects the victim to the physical risks associated with sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy. As such, it creates a serious potential risk of physical injury and is therefore a crime of violence under 4B1.2A2.
Well, we're talking about adults and not children, for one thing. And I don't think this court is going to be sorry.
What's the relevancy of the difference in age? It's the risk of disease and or pregnancy. Now, maybe a young child might not be able to get pregnant before a certain age or puberty, but... certainly there's a risk of sexual disease that affects both adults and children equally.
Of course, I agree with that. But where we're talking about forcible, the concern in Riley, I thought, had to do with a forcible situation where somebody comes to and is suddenly finding themselves and has consciousness now.
Well, I think we were talking about the foreseeability of harm, which is what 4B1.2 addresses. In determining whether or not the criminal behavior poses or constitutes a crime of violence. And in this case, our court said that part of the violence analysis is what is a foreseeable injury to the victim. And sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy, aside from, you know, battery and tearing and so on, are all part of that analysis, are they not?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I thought that this court has specifically not reached the question of whether or not sexual penetration inherently is a dangerous act.
Riley doesn't need to go that far. Riley simply says risk of disease is good enough.
Oh no, I thought, I mean this with all due respect. I thought Riley, the risk that was addressed in Riley had to do with somebody being either asleep or unconscious or comatose or in stupor,
right,
and coming to, and that there's a risk created in that situation because then there's going to be resistance and there's going to be force.
Okay.
And that I thought that that was the serious risk that presented itself in Riley. That
I read it as a series of risks.
I'm quite baffled by your argument. I guess I just don't understand. 470 says that for purposes of 410, it defines a bunch of terms. First of all, including this one, unless the context requires otherwise, meaning the linguistic context, right? Mm-hmm. You seem to be talking about the factual context.
They haven't. I mean, because it is, that term isn't defined, and I looked through the Alaska.
What term isn't defined?
That term, unless the context requires.
But that's obviously what it means. It's a definitional section, and it's saying that this is what these words mean, unless in the particular linguistic context, it apparently means something else.
Well, what do we do with the fact that there's a context, for example, elsewhere in the Alaska statutes that describes what an incapacitated person is? Wouldn't that be a context in which we might be dealing with a more expansive definition of what incapacity is? And that's my point. If it's limited to just statutory context, then elsewhere in the Alaska statutes is an alternative definition of an incapacitated person. If it's factual, I think initially when I approached this, I was thinking, what if it's a factual context? What if it's factually variable? Then that's really problematical. But
where is this other definition of incapacity?
I had just located this. It's at Alaska Statute 13.26.
Is that in your brief anywhere?
It's not. I just located it yesterday, and I'll be happy to put it in a 28J letter. But
this is not the argument you made before.
That there was an alternative definition. I wasn't aware that there was an alternative definition at the time I wrote my brief.
And what is the alternative definition?
It's at the Alaska Statute 1326.005. An incapacitated person is a person whose ability to receive and evaluate information to the extent the person lacks the ability to provide the essential requirements that's essentially what an incapacitated person is.
But that still goes to the consent issue, doesn't it? And if I'm right, if what we were talking about in Riley was more than simply consent to sexual intercourse, if the risk of harm is in fact a relevant factor to determining whether it's a crime of violence, then you've only addressed a portion of the foreseeable harm.
Well, I think that my argument about the incapacitated person issue is that where the court could define incapacity effectively is based upon somebody's legal status and not whether or not they have the awareness that sexual penetration is taking place. I think that that expands the definition so broadly that it doesn't comport with a categorical crime of violence. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, I'm Joanne Farrington, Assistant United States Attorney here in Alaska. Taylor cases are always somewhat frustrating. Judge Boudin said in the Shepherd decision that was destined to be reversed by the Supreme Court that there's surely an air of make-believe about this case. But nevertheless, I recognize both the constitutional and the practical reasons for the Taylor
opinion. Only because the government chooses to go on the categorical approach. I mean, you could prove up the offense as committed.
That could have been done, though.
And the reason we get into these problems of what Judge Boudin referred to and what you referred to, which we've had a demonstration this morning here by the questions we've asked, there's a real Alice in Wonderland aspect of it is because the government doesn't choose to put in actual evidence. And maybe that's the thing to do, is to send the case back and have you guys prove it up and take away the make-believe aspect of it.
Well,
That's not necessary in this case. In some cases, it might be. But in this case...
That's a relief. I was coming out of you, and maybe there was no other way out.
In this case, I think that both of these offenses are, on their face, categorical crimes of violence. They meet the first prong of the failure test.
The generic definition of crimes of violence. Let's talk about the sexual assault first.
That does seem to be the focus of concern, and I believe that Riley controls the decision in this case. The defense has attempts to distinguish Riley with an argument that at first I had trouble even understanding. The definition of sexual assault in the second degree includes incapacitated victims. The phrase that the defense focuses on, unless the context requires otherwise, is an introductory phrase to an entire list of definitions. It's standard statutory language, and it's linguistic. It's unless one of these words is used in a way at some point in the statute that clearly indicates by context that it means something else, this is what it means. Incapacitated is then defined as temporarily incapable of apprising the nature of one's own conduct or physically unable to express unwillingness to act. If those two, there is no other factual context in which it could mean anything else and still constitute a violation of statute. The alternative definition of incapacitated that the defense has put forward today applies to different statutes. For purposes,
explicitly so, and that's why it says, for purposes of this statute, it means incapacitated.
Exactly, explicitly so. That is the definition of incapacitated for purposes of the sexual offense statutes. Right? And another definition somewhere else for other purposes in the Alaska statutes is irrelevant. Beyond that...
I'm sorry, and what does that include?
The definition that was read to you this morning is somewhat broader.
I understand. The applicable definition includes what?
I'm sorry. Under second-degree sexual assault?
Yes.
What the definition is? In order to be incapacitated, an individual has to be temporarily incapable of appraising the nature of one's own conduct or physically unable to express unwillingness to act. One of those... two factual conditions has to be met in order for the defendant to be guilty.
And in the first category, you say you fit what? You fit the person who is drunk?
A person who is so drunk that they are unable to understand the nature of their conduct.
Or drugged.
Or drugged.
Or possibly in a deep sleep.
Possibly. At that point, they would be physically unable to express unwillingness to act, which is the alternative.
I guess I would also put on that.
That's right.
And what about below the age of consent?
That's not covered by the statute. That statutory rape is a separate offense, defined separately.
And why is that not covered? Explain that to me.
Because a child is... capable of appraising the nature of their conduct in general, unless it's a very small child, I suppose.
Rivas Gomez said was that that's the nature of being below the age of consent, that you really can't. That you may know exactly what you're doing, you may want to do it, but that you can't fully appreciate the consequences, including the consequences of disease, the consequences of pregnancy, consequences of physical injury. And so even though in some sense the person perceives and is able to speak and is able to sort of perceive, know what's going on, they don't have, by law, the ability to appreciate, and that's part of it. So I'm just wondering why that does not apply here.
Well, I would say, statutory rape may be a crime of violence under federal law. I was just suggesting that it was not intended to be covered by the situation of an incapacitated victim under Alaska law.
That's exactly what your position is. I'm trying to get you to persuade me that, in fact, you're correct about that.
Well, I certainly...
Why that phrase that you read me would not cover, let's say, a 12-year-old? Would you read the phrase again, just for my community?
One thing, it says temporarily capable.
Well, that's the thing about you.
Incapacitated means temporarily incapable of appraising the nature of one's own conduct, or physically unable to express unwillingness to act. And my only point is that I don't think the statute was intended to apply to children. I certainly have never seen it applied to children. Alaska has other statutes that cover the situation of a child. I would not argue that this covers that situation. But
well,
if it did...
Of course you wouldn't argue it because you are not prosecuting somebody for statutory rape. What you're trying to do is to make this fit within the categorical definition.
That's right.
The person arguing it would be your opposing counsel, who would say, look, the definition is broad enough so that another prosecutor at another time could bring a statutory rape conviction under prosecution under that definition. So now you have to put yourself not in the shoes of an assistant United States attorney. You have to put yourself in the shoes of the district attorney of here in Anchorage, who now wants to prosecute some guy for having sexual relations with a girl who's, I don't know what the age of consent is here, but, you know, just below that. So it's temporary. She's about to cross the threshold to be able to do it. And he says, well, but she's not now. You know, and so it fits. So how would you deal with that argument by the prosecutor that, you know, I can prosecute what is essentially a statutory rape under this definition of unconsidered sex as rape?
Now I think I understand the point that you're making, that if the statute...
I knew if I threw enough words at you.
I'd make
myself understood.
If the statute could be read as being broad enough to encompass statutory rape, is it still a crime of violence? And my answer to that would be yes. If a child is young enough that they are incapable of appraising the nature of their conduct, then I believe that is, and I believe that the precedent
well,
of this court recognizes.
By law, they're young enough until the night that they magically turn into adult. You know, at midnight they become, so, you know, one day before they're legally incapable of doing it, an hour later or 2 hours later when midnight passes and it's their birthday and they pass the age of consent, they're magically able to do it. That's how the law works. You may be just as smart the night before, but you are below the age of consent and therefore deemed by law incapable of assessing the risks.
I don't believe that the statute covers the situation where
the statute says incapable of appraising the nature of one's own conduct, which I understand to mean knowing what you're doing in a cognitive sense.
That's right. And I think it's a factual.
Well, that's certainly one way of looking at it. But why isn't it legally the legal inability to assess the risks? Person says, you know, I can understand. You know, I've studied these diseases. I know exactly what's going on. And we say, too bad. By law, you can't do it. Well, why isn't that also perfectly good? Situation to follow that definition?
I focus on the word incapable there because I believe that's a factual word. We aren't going to let you, as a matter of law, do it. It's you are incapable of doing it, which I would read, one would argue, is a factual determination of the capability of the victim.
Okay.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to use my remaining time, if I could, to...
Well, you don't really have any.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How about
I
a minute? You have minus 3.5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
We'll give you a minute. We'll give you a minute, though. We'll sort of magically...
I just want to check one thing. You agree that if we upheld the two priors, the pop-up wouldn't matter? Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, it was an argument that was a challenge that was made to the pre-sentence report and was never ruled on by the court.
I understand. I think
it does matter in this post-Booker context in this regard, which is if the court is looking at the full range of conduct by the defendant and at using that under 3553 to determine really what the nature of the offense is. And yet it accepts as a given this factual, this characterization of the act that would basically allow for a sentencing enhancement. I think it's wrong to let that be undisturbed. What was a kind of a default finding or acceptance of the pre-sentence report characterization.
The two priors made him a career criminal,
yes,
which
it
is
did.
Still a guidelines concept, so there was still discretion involved. Is that right?
There was discretion involved, and the court did exercise discretion, but obviously if we assume that the court looked at the full nature of the offense, it made a wrong factual characterization to the extent its determinations can be read as accepting that four-level bump. So I think a remand would be appropriate.
Why can't the district judge under 3553A look at the actual conduct as set forth in the pre-sentence report without regard to the guideline calculation and take the seriousness of the defendant's behavior into an account in fashioning an appropriate sentence in this case?
Oh, it certainly can and should. And I think my point is that it's not clear that the court did that because the court accepted the findings of the pre-sentence report.
Right.
And
you don't challenge the facts of the pre-sentence report. Your argument was a legal one, as I understood it.
Well, it's a factual characterization.
That's not what I'm asking. Maybe I'm not making myself clear. The district court was given a fairly detailed accounting in the pre-sentence report as to exactly what your client did at the pool hall and as to the circumstances surrounding the incapacitated sex. And why can't the district court consider the factual details of what the defendant did under 3553A in ultimately fashioning an appropriate sentence without regard to what the guideline would characterize that behavior as?
I completely misunderstood your question.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about the emboldening, whether or not, in fact, his possession of the firearm was emboldening conduct, which would have been an erroneous factual finding. What was in the pre-sentence report was, by the way, a recitation from a complaint, which was not the document to which the defendant entered a plea of no contest.
No, but you're going back into guidelines analysis, and I'm stepping away from the guidelines. Forget about the guidelines. Now I'm looking at a judge who is trying to determine under the statutory factors of 3553A what an appropriate sentence should be. What's a reasonable punishment for the crime that I'm going to sentence this individual on based upon his record of past crimes and criminal behavior as set forth in the details of the pre-sentence report?
Well, I think that the focus of the court was somewhat different because of the Taylor analysis.
Taylor analysis doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about. Taylor analysis deals with guideline calculations and whether or not the court can look beyond certain admissible or noticeable documents in determining enhancements.
Well, I think there's no reason why the court can't. I mean, the court, in fact, under 3553, is supposed to look at the history of the defendant.
Right.
And so, surely, you know, looking at the history of an offense, of a past offense, can be part and parcel of that. But what the record in this case would seem to indicate is that the judge was his determinations were completely directed by, related to, with reference to the career offender determinations. And so,
why couldn't he be influenced? The assault with the firearm at the pool hall was a pretty serious assault with a firearm case. I mean, when you're pointing a loaded gun at somebody and telling them that their name is on the bullet that's in the chamber, that's a pretty clear felony assault. And why can't that behavior inform the district court's thinking in deciding whether or not this individual should be given maybe a little higher sentence than he would for a different kind of an assault that didn't involve such life-threatening behavior?
Well, I think it could, but I don't think that that's how the district court's decision reads. I mean, on the flip side of that, then there's a second-degree sexual assault for which he received no time in jail, a wholly suspended 2-year sentence. And so I don't think the court's determinations really do reflect that specific consideration of the prior history. I think that he's looking at the career offender enhancements and whether or not they're appropriate.
I mean, there's a certain amount, and I realize we're struggling with it in our jurisprudence. There's a certain amount of tension here between a Supreme Court ruling that tells us that the guidelines are no longer mandatory and arguments that we are hearing from you and other good criminal defense lawyers that really wants to push us back into that mandatory system when it's to your client's advantage. But I'm still trying to decide what it means under this advisory system where the court has told us that what really counts is reasonableness, and for that we must look at and articulate the 3553A factors in fashioning an appropriate sentence in a particular case.
Well, I guess with respect to this case, how I would answer that, Your Honor, is, of course, I think it's wholly appropriate that in fashioning a post-Booker sentence that you get to consider the history of the defendant encompassing the prior offenses. But I don't think in this case that really occurred, because I think what happened was that the court really was preoccupied with those career offender characterizations and really did not, I mean, there's nothing in the record that talks about the fact that the second degree sexual assault, for example, resulted in a wholly suspended 2-year sentence.
But he had that before him. That's in the pre-sentence report. You can read it right on.
But his decision making and how he tracks his decision making in the transcript of the imposition of sentence shows that he was completely fueled and directed by the sentencing guidelines. So, no, I think a more holistic approach is indicated by Booker, and I don't think it's necessarily present here on this record.
Okay.
Thank you.
Holistic, that's a good word.
Holistic, I like that.
Okay,
holistic.
That's a good word.
We like that.
It means almost anything anybody wants it to mean. Which society will stand submitted. We'll next the argument in State Farm, Fire, and Casualty Insurance Company versus Hatches.